From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very grateful for your support. Today, as the world around us changes in unsettling and unexpected ways, it's more important than ever to provide this platform for thoughtful, respectful dialogue and voices that all too often go unheard. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, June 11th is the Christian Trinity Sunday, and Thursday is the Catholic Feast of Corpus Christi. On Friday, 6 Mark, the martyrdom of Guru Arjan, and the Muslim holy month of Ramadan continues until June 24th. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this week saw new lows in the demonization of Muslims across the globe. Even as Londoners inspired the world with breathtaking courage and resilience in the face of another terror attack, Donald Trump thought this was the perfect opportunity to double down on his call for a Muslim travel ban, even before taking the time to express sympathy for our closest ally. Political leaders, ranging from a sitting U.S. congressman demanding we kill them all, to Australians suggesting internment camps for any Muslims even suspected of connection to terrorism after a Melbourne hostage standoff left 2 people dead. And in a further sign of how deep the empathy deficit disorder plaguing many conservatives has become, the U.S. Senate voted to increase draconian sanctions on Iran merely days after that country elected a moderate president. And on the same day as a horrific ISIS attack killed 13 and injured 40. Meanwhile, a Christian monastery in Mosul, Iraq, that was heavily damaged by ISIS terrorists is being restored. Listen. And the work is being done by local Muslims and Christians working together. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
Brainwashing is really nothing more than a confidence game. And a cult leader is running a con.
There are people who will find any comparison of fervent Trump fandom to a religious cult offensive and insulting. And there are others who are likely to raise an eyebrow and say, that makes a lot of sense. Despite the risks involved, I'm going down this route today in the company of one of the nation's preeminent experts on the subject and head of the Cult Education Institute. His name is Rick Ross.
The decision of President Trump to withdraw from the Paris Agreement is extremely dangerous.
I do think it is an actual mistake.
At least 10 states across the country have said they're still committed to the accord.
We've had time now to digest the news that the president has withdrawn from the global Paris Climate Change Agreement. What about rapidly growing faith-inspired environmentalists? On this week's show, we'll get an update from Green Faith Executive Director Fletcher Harper. But first,
the administration then chose to defame me and, more importantly, the FBI by saying that the organization was in disarray, that it was poorly led, that the workforce had lost confidence in its leader. Those were lies, plain and simple.
The past couple of days have been consumed with commentary and analysis regarding fired FBI Director James Comey's testimony before Congress. Joining me right now is Rabbi Jack Moline, president of Interfaith Alliance. Jack, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. It's always a pleasure to be here.
What were your thoughts as you watched this hearing and heard about this hearing on Thursday?
I was distressed to hear how much there appeared to be a breach of protocol, certainly of common sense, and maybe even the law. It is, I think, a crisis for those of us who believe in the promise and the realization of this country's dream, that we have this intrigue going on in the palace that has nothing to do with what's really important to Americans and to America. What we are beginning to see in these investigations of the president's activities is in a very peculiar way what we saw during Watergate. In the end, President Nixon was not done in by the actions of the people in his sphere. He was done in by his attempt to cover up and obfuscate what happened. And if that's what's going on in the White House right now, it only causes me more concern that the president now doesn't learn from the lessons of history.
Without naming names, can you comment on whether lawmakers you speak to are more gravely concerned about and more importantly committed to addressing the state of our nation and executive branch than they let on in public?
Yes, I can tell you, having talked to people on both sides of the aisle, that people are 100% concerned about the future of the country. There's no question that party politics and partisanship is still alive in Washington. But I think even the casual observer can see, in looking at the statements that are coming from leadership in both parties, that there is a grave concern here that we not lose ground that we have worked so hard over all these decades to gain.
Is there any chance, Jack, that these people on both sides of the aisle are talking with each other in ways that they are not talking in public?
Oh, I think there's every chance of that. And I'm not sure it is, whether it is motivated by a certain patriotism or whether it's just motivated by the practicalities of needing to govern. But everybody recognizes that a dysfunctional White House is not good for the country. Mm-hmm. It's also not good, frankly, for either party, but it is primarily not good for the country, and they have absolutely addressed that with each other. Absolutely.
Is public pressure at all effective? Because there have been successful efforts on the right to convince conservatives that any protests against the Trump agenda are just Soros-sponsored political theater. So are there voices that are actually being heard from the public that are making a difference in what goes on?
I think the answer to that is yes. I'm not sure how much of the public I represent, but I will tell you, I'm pleased to share with our audience that that this past Monday, I was part of a very small delegation that was invited into the Justice Department to speak with lawyers in the Civil Rights Division about an agenda moving forward. And the president's executive order, as I think everybody knows, on religious freedom was a little vague, and they were looking for guidance. They've been speaking to people across the spectrum on what they ought to be doing in order to protect religious freedoms and civil rights in the country. And the voices of people are being heard at the policy implementation level, which is, I think, far more important than whether people are happy with the president himself.
Yeah. Would you talk about the president's decision to not make any proclamation for LGBT Pride Month this year, but instead to address the brutally anti-gay Faith and Freedom Coalition's conference just a couple of days before Washington's Pride celebration this weekend?
Yeah, the question is its own answer. Well, you know, the president was elected with significant support from the evangelical community. Mm-hmm. And his emphasis on loyalty to his supporters and loyalty from his supporters means that when he has the opportunity to provide them with some validation, especially if it costs him nothing, he's going to do it. There really is no excuse in this day and age for any government official not to acknowledge the place that LGBT individuals and the LGBT community as a whole now plays in our society, in our culture, in our politics. We all know that the religious right is more about politics than it is about religion.
Right.
And you're famous for saying the religious right is neither. So it's not a surprise to me that given the opportunity to stroke a community that supported him and ignore a community that pretty much abandoned him, he made the choice that he did. He has not brought this country together. He has instead exacerbated the partisan divides that helped put him into office.
Interfaith Alliance is publicly calling for a U.S. congressman to step down. I'm very pleased the Interfaith Alliance is doing that. I am very sad that, again, such action comes from Louisiana. Would you talk about what prompted this action of asking a congressman or suggesting a congressman step down?
Sure. We're talking about Representative Clay Higgins from the 3rd District of Louisiana. It's the Gulf Coast District that is west of New Orleans. He refers to himself as the Cajun John Wayne. He has almost a cartoonish approach to public office. He was removed as a spokesperson for the law enforcement department where he was previously employed, and the local party found him to be an attractive candidate in an era of extreme partisanship and extreme pronunciation. When he posted on his Facebook page after the deep tragedy in London that the free world, and he equated that with Christendom, was in a war against the horrors of Islam, and that our mission should be to hunt them down, identify them, and kill them all, and that's a direct quote, Interfaith Alliance, all of us, recognized immediately that we had a public official who was not only calling for extrajudicial murder, but was also, not insignificantly, violating the Constitution that he had not many weeks ago taken an oath to protect and uphold, establishing one particular religion as dominant and justifying acts in the name of that religious tradition on behalf of the United States, slamming another religious tradition and lumping all Muslims together on the basis of the actions of some few outliers. Mm-hmm. And his clarifications weren't any better. He simply said, well, I don't mean all Muslims, I just mean the bad ones. But let's round them up, question them all, and then anybody who isn't guilty, we'll let them go with our apologies. Mm-hmm. This is a man who has no business serving in the House of Representatives. There are 434 other lawmakers of integrity who are suffering because this bad apple is in their basket. And so we called for his resignation, and if he doesn't have the integrity to do that, for the House to expel him.
Why was it important for the Interfaith Alliance to take a stand on this when a lot of other organizations seem to have just let it go by?
I think a lot of other organizations are looking at a bigger picture of policy issues and behaviors in the White House. And I think if people start paying attention, they're going to see that there's a lot going on of bad behavior by individual lawmakers, particularly those who came to office campaigning with a partisan agenda, with an anti-Muslim agenda, with sometimes a racial agenda, and they feel free to say these things because it was validated at the highest levels of the campaign. Mm-hmm. Interfaith Alliance has always stood for civility, has always stood for the healing power of religion, has always stood for the importance of protecting the most vulnerable among us from the natural inclination of humanity to stereotype on the basis of a few actions. So we were the ones who would notice this immediately. I suspect that we'll be in coalition with lots of other people pretty soon.
Yeah. I want you to talk briefly about the other work the Alliance is engaged in and how listeners can get involved and support that work.
We've had actually a terrific couple of weeks where we have been contacted by people in places where we do not at the moment have alliances, asking how they can organize their friends into an Interfaith Alliance affiliate in their home state or their hometown. Reach out to us. We would be glad to work with you on that. The voices of people in states and localities are at least as important as the voice of Interfaith Alliance that comes from Washington, D.C., because those are the people that local officials and even federal officials elected at a local level are going to listen to. So number one is getting together with your compatriots, your friends, your colleagues, and working with Interfaith Alliance. It will help to provide that guidance. Of course, keeping us in business and keeping us thriving is also important. We're about to embark on the fruition of two campaigns that we've been working on. One is the redistribution of our Truth About Muslim Americans FAQ. It was developed under your administration. We want to put that in the hands of every federal legislator and every governor in the country to counteract some of the nonsense that's being spread by people who are Islamophobes. And our mapping project has entered its second year. We're at the point now where we've begun to engage our panels of scholars and analysts who will look at some of the data that we have in front of us and provide the kinds of materials that are necessary for conversation and learning and advocacy. So contributions will help us get where we're going.
Rabbi Jack Moline is president of Interfaith Alliance, working to protect true religious freedom for all Americans. State of Belief is one of a number of important Interfaith Alliance initiatives. Find out more at interfaithalliance.org. I know the challenge, and I just want to say thank you for what you're doing, and as always, thanks for taking time to be with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton.
Weeks after that poll showing 98% of Trump voters had no regrets about their decision, I can't get that number out of my head. 98%. Really? Because I've heard too many people describe this devotion as cult-like. I thought a sober analysis of that accusation was in order, and so I am pleased to be joined by one of the nation's preeminent experts on the subject, the founder and executive director of the Cult Education Institute. His name is Rick Ross. Rick, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. Nice to be on.
Would you start with just a very brief overview of the work that's being done in your institute?
The Cult Education Institute is an online library database that's been under construction since 1996. It has tens of thousands of research articles and documents divided into hundreds of subsections, and it is literally an online library member of the American Library Association, and it is utilized by thousands of people each day for research purposes.
Are there actual parallels between cult-like behavior you see in your work and what you see in some of the president's biggest fans?
Well, I think that Donald Trump is a very charismatic leader, and that is the single most salient feature of groups called cults, is that they are defined by a charismatic leader and that they're personality-driven and that people become enthralled with that personality. Another thing that seems to be reminiscent of groups called cults is the kind of insular nature of many people that are true believers in Donald Trump. And that is that they kind of cocoon themselves through social media, through which news outlets they choose, so that there's a kind of echo chamber that surrounds them that reinforces their beliefs. And then there also, I believe, is a phenomenon known as cognitive dissonance that occurs. That is, when you believe in something and it's factually contradicted, you will accept the spin of the leader and the leadership of your group as to what the reason for this discrepancy is. You'll accept that spin no matter how unusual or not factually based it is. And then because you're in this cocoon, it's then reinforced by other true believers in that echo chamber. And I've seen that play out again and again, that is cognitive dissonance, with many of the people that talk about Donald Trump and how they continue to believe in him even when he's caught in a lie.
That's a really scary phenomenon, and I guess that is intrinsic with cultic behavior. Is that right?
Well, basically, a cult leader is always right, and if you disagree with him, you must be wrong. And cult leaders typically don't apologize. They're very narcissistic. They simply are insistent that they are always correct, mm-hmm. and that they have the solution to every problem. What I found interesting about Donald Trump is in his acceptance speech at the Republican National Convention, he stated that I alone can fix it when talking about the United States and our current situation. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, he saw himself as the one and only, which was very reminiscent of, to me, of how many cult leaders see themselves.
What makes somebody an effective cult leader?
I think the ability to manipulate people, the ability to press all the right buttons emotionally and psychologically. Typically, the more charismatic the leader, they'll garner a greater following. And also to tap into the themes of popular culture. And what you see with cult leaders is they will concoct a kind of facade or formula for their group that is derivative of whatever is popular in mainstream culture. For example, Marshall Applewhite, who led a group called Heaven's Gate, which committed suicide in 1997 in California. It was a little bit Christianity, a lot Doomsday, but quite a bit of Star Trek and sci-fi. And in the same way, I think Donald Trump has tapped into what people are afraid of, what people care about, what are the themes in popular culture to propel his own popularity and preeminence.
I know that you've worked with deprogramming cult members. What are the challenges to breaking through with a cult member?
The number one key is to lift the person out of that echo chamber, to do a family intervention when they are away from the group, and then to ask them gently, please don't communicate with the group during this time discussing your family's concerns. So they turn off their smartphone, they don't get on the web, and they listen to their family and their friends who are concerned about them and why are they concerned. Mm-hmm. And then they get an alternate perspective. They have an outside frame of reference that they previously did not have. And then basically what the intervention is education. So you share information about the group that they may not have known, about the leader that they may not have known. And then you talk about the phenomenon of cognitive dissonance, of how influence techniques can affect people. And you really kind of have a meaningful discussion about the fragility of the human mind and how we are all vulnerable to these influence techniques. Mm-hmm. And hopefully then they can catch the parallels between what you're laying out in research and that resonates with what their experience is in their particular group or with their leader.
Are there risks in challenging cult members' beliefs? Does outside information just make their beliefs stronger?
Well, in many instances, when I sit down with people to do an intervention, they just simply refuse to talk. and they walk out the door, despite the family's pleas. So there are many people that I successfully do interventions with. I've done over 500 across the United States and around the world. My success rate is about 3 out of 4, 75%. And I write about this in great detail in my book, Cults Inside Out, How People Get In and Can Get Out. So if a person I'm working with just completely rejects what is being said, or they communicate with the group and the group may say, leave immediately. We don't want you to discuss anything with your family. In fact, cut your family off and don't go back to visit with them, because if they don't support us and agree with us, or they raise critical questions about us, we don't want them as part of your life. And again, that reflects this cocooning effect of cutting out and cutting yourself away from any alternate perspective or outside frame of reference.
Rick, when did you first begin thinking of your work and its relationship to Donald Trump?
I really felt it was right about the time of the Republican National Convention when he said, I alone can fix it. That really was a point where everything kind of pulled together. And, of course, as I was watching many of the rallies and the chanting for him and some of the aggressive behavior at those rallies and that kind of we-they dichotomy where anyone that disagreed with the crowd was somehow vilified and there was no tolerance for ambiguity, there was no tolerance for another perspective. I mean, it was a very angry kind of campaign. It wasn't really positive in that sense. And then when he finally came to the convention and he said, I alone can fix it, that really kind of was the glue that kind of brought it all together. In addition, whenever he was criticized, the way that his followers repeatedly would discount factual information, would go into this phenomenon that I've described of cognitive dissonance. You know, after a while, if it quacks like a duck and it walks like a duck, you know, you just call it a duck.
Yes. Well, look, knowing what you know, do you have any insights into what might be coming next?
Well, first of all, I thank God that we live in a democratic republic. You know, we have a democracy, and President Trump was elected by the American people. He's accountable to the laws of our country, to the Constitution. We will have continuing elections. He is accountable to the Senate, to the House, and we have an independent Justice Department and an FBI. So there are checks and balances within our country that there simply don't exist in a destructive cult where the leader is a totalitarian dictator and has no checks and balances. So going forward, I have faith in our system, our institutions, and again, I just thank God that we have a free country and that we live in a free country.
Wonderful, wonderful insights. Would you tell our listeners about what services are available from the Cult Education Institute and how to get more information on your work?
The Cult Education Institute is a nonprofit educational 501c3. You can reach the Institute database by going to culteducation.com. There you will find a huge database of information with a search feature so that you can find information on all kinds of controversial groups and movements, some that have been called cults. There is also a message board that has been up for many years that has over 130,000 individual entries from people that have been affected by cults, from families, from former cult members, and the public can participate at that message board. There's also a virtual library of listing of books in partnership with Amazon.com where people can see many, many books available about cults, including my own book, Cults Inside Out. And then there is a links page with links to additional resources about specific groups and also more general information about cults. The Cult Education Institute has an archive on YouTube, also has a Facebook presence. You can follow the Cult Education Institute on Twitter. And there is cultnews.com and cultnews.net, where people can keep up on breaking stories about controversial groups and movements.
Rick Ross is the founder and executive director of the Cult Education Institute. He is an internationally known expert regarding destructive cults, controversial groups, and movements since 1982. He's been studying, researching, and responding to the problems often posed by such groups or movements. Rick, thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
You know, it seems like a long time ago, but in reality, the president's shocking attempt to pull the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Agreement only happened on the first day of June. An ever-growing list of American states, sites, and corporations have rejected Donald Trump's rejection of this global pact and committed to individually do their part to stick to the previous administration's agreement. In light of these developments, what about faith-inspired environmental groups and activists? Is there a role for them to follow this model as well? Good questions, and we have the right person here to answer them. Reverend Fletcher Harper is Executive Director of Green Faith. Fletcher, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. Good to be with you.
I'm curious, what were your first thoughts when you heard the news about Donald Trump's Paris decision?
It was stunningly disappointing and disheartening. The reality is that we had known because of steps that the administration had already taken to dismantle the positive commitments that the prior administration had made to try to enable the country to meet its moral obligations to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. So we knew that with dismantling of a lot of those steps, there was a functional inability for the U.S. to meet its Paris commitments. But then to have the announcement of the outright rejection of Paris and starting the process of withdrawal for the U.S., it was a real gut punch. So not a pleasant day.
What are your greatest concerns about this change of direction for our nation?
My greatest concern is that the science is overwhelmingly clear that this gift that is the source of support for our life, the planet Earth, that its climate is under grave stress, and that the rate of increase of greenhouse gas emissions is continuing at a level that more severe storm activity, more intense droughts, and all of the problems that result from that will be creating massively greater numbers of refugees, will be displacing poor farmers from their farms and their homes, turning them into refugees, will be putting millions of people, many of them very poor, at risk from the increased severe storm activity and the related destruction of infrastructure and homes and increased spread of disease that results from that. We know that all of these things are going to happen because of this decision. And that's my greatest concern, is that large numbers of people, most of them poor, most of them who've done next to nothing to contribute to this problem, will pay the price, along with the stability of the ecosystems that we believe represent part of the majesty of the gift of God that this planet is.
Can you even guess why the president took this step? I've been confused about it, because people that he usually listens to were telling him not to take this approach. The business community that he usually listens to was telling him how bad this would be for the economy as well as for the climate. Can you guess why the president took this step?
Well, I think if one takes him at his word, the overriding concern and the way that he framed it was concern for American workers. And I want to say that when faith communities have communicated about the climate crisis, we have done a good job of communicating about impacts on poor and vulnerable communities, frontline communities.
Mm-hmm.
We have not done enough talking about the importance of providing for the protection of workers, the necessary level of job training and transitional support that's going to be required for lots of workers and many communities around the country and around the world as the world makes its clean energy transition. While I am under absolutely no illusion that the president, for example, is going to bring back the coal industry we must recognize as an industry that is dying around the country and around the world. And the compassionate and substantive way to engage with and to support that community is to make sure that there is a robust level of funding and support for retraining, for continued health care, for income maintenance, for other ways of stabilizing the lives of those tens of thousands of coal workers around the U.S. who eventually will need to make that kind of transition. I also think from a political perspective, it's likely that the president felt that he could generate enthusiasm from within his most ardent base of supporters. But my concern is what really happens to real people because of this decision. And that's not good.
It just baffles me how a major leader in any country cannot answer the question, do you believe in climate change? And we can't even get that out of him.
Well, I think that's, and again, I'm going to speak very, you know, we know that within faith communities in the United States, there are faith communities who feel the need to reject that. I don't agree with that, but we must recognize that there are significant and culturally and politically influential faith communities, including many on the more conservative end of the Christian spectrum, who feel that way. And what I'd like to say publicly is to reach out an olive branch. Those faith communities are, in many cases, also supporting really important outreach, humanitarian relief in various developing countries, different types of community development programming that they operate. Those communities that they are, as Christians, committed to helping are the very communities that will be hurt most by this decision. And so what I'd like to sort of urge is that we find a way within the Christian community to open up this conversation and to find ways to act on the values that we all share, a respect for God, a respect for God's creation, the dignity of human beings, support for the flourishing of the human community. And those core values are ones that we have to come together around as a faith community if we want to see progress around this.
Fletcher, a lot of analysts have explained that this is not an agreement a country can just pull out of at the drop of a hat. What do we need to understand about that?
So on the technical level, what's good about this agreement, and it was written up this way intentionally because when you have 200 countries around the world signing on to an agreement, the agreement has to have has to be something that can withstand short-term political pressures.
Mm-hmm.
And so the process that what President Trump is able to do is to begin the process of withdrawing from the Paris Agreement. But that's a process that takes 4 years per the terms of the agreement. And so there is on that level, it's not something that, you know, he just snaps his fingers, makes an announcement, and it's done. I think that what matters, and this gets back to something you said earlier, is on a functional level, the federal government in the United States will not be taking the steps that it had previously pledged to take to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in this country. And that's where it is vitally important for cities, towns, states, universities, faith institutions, to not just to pledge, but truly to follow through and make good on pledges to make very, very substantial reductions in our own greenhouse gas emissions. Mm-hmm. And the We Are Still In petition movement that emerged out of the Center for American Progress has been an important early stage voice for that. There are, other thoughts being debated about how best to approach this. But what I think is really important to say is that over the past, 4 to 5 years, because of the importance of first reaching the Paris Agreement and then supporting its adoption, a very large percentage of the work within faith communities on climate change has been focused on political advocacy around that process, which has been vitally important. We now need to add to that process a commitment to profound reductions in greenhouse gas emissions by people of faith and by their faith communities as part of this. We need to maintain the advocacy, and we need now ourselves to start to walk the talk at a heretofore at a level that up till now has been getting started, but it needs to ramp up dramatically.
Are there member groups in Green Faith who are looking to do this kind of work?
Absolutely, and in about a month's time, we believe that we'll have an exciting announcement about that. It's not quite ready yet, but this is something that Green Faith, along with many other faith-based environmental groups, has worked on for any number of years. Earth Ministry in Seattle, the Interfaith Power and Light Network, other groups have worked on reducing and have encouraged the reduction of the carbon footprint of their faith communities. So it's this is something that has been out there and now needs to take a newfound level of prominence.
I think it's important too, Fletcher, for people in the pews, people in the streets, in their own locales, understanding that what they do can really make an impact on this critical issue. And I wish you'd just make that pitch about the importance of individuals' involvements here.
Absolutely. And I think that there are two ways I'd frame it. One is that here in the United States, we have, because of the way in which our society and economy and infrastructure are structured, the environmental impact that we have is just about the highest in the world on a per capita basis. And so when we take steps to reduce the energy that we consume, the amount of energy that we consume, to transition and purchase energy from a renewable source, we literally make the impact that it takes 15 or 20 people to make in other countries. Mm. So there's a very real impact in that kind of way, which over the course of a lifetime really truly adds up. And if our faith communities find a way to encourage that kind of behavior as a norm, the impact very quickly scales up and becomes real and substantive. I think that too often there's been a tendency to write off the importance of individual behavior change by climate advocates. And, the second way that I'd frame this is, when we talk about issues like racial prejudice, we recognize the deep interconnection between our own personal values and behavior and the policies and behaviors and regulations and values of society at large. We don't make or allow for that kind of bifurcation when we talk about that. It's the same thing with hunger or poverty. Faith groups for years have recognized that the basis of a strong, humane society is where there are strong government policies that protect and support those who are poor and vulnerable, and also where local faith communities are pitching in a very hands-on way. The enormity of the problem of poverty, I've never heard a church or a synagogue or a mosque say, oh, you know, this problem is so big, I'm not going to do anything about it. So I think that we need to reintroduce this concept of the importance of our own personal, you know, some people call it ecological discipleship, and be willing to learn what it means to live more faithfully in regards to our consumption habits.
The Reverend Fletcher Harper is an ordained minister who heads the Innovative Green Faith Coalition as executive director. Fletcher, you are working at such a key confluence of issues right now, faith and environment concerns. You are doing it well. I want to commend you for the way you articulate the issues as well as the way you are motivating people to get into this movement. And thanks for what you're doing, and thanks so much for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thanks very much for the chance to be with you and your audience. We appreciate it greatly.
Well, my goodness, that's all the time we have for this week's show. There are people listening to this show right now who are having a tough time. They may be at a loss to understand how the values this country presents on the world stage have changed so completely and so quickly. Or they may be incredibly angry, caught up in the cycle of rage that seems to have infected our public discourse. We hear from these people every week, and we know this program and your generous support of this program makes an enormous difference. I want to say thank you. Thank you for your support. I hope you'll keep it up. If you've heard something on State of Belief Radio this week that you found to be helpful, I urge you to share it with others who might also find it helpful. It's easy to do that on Facebook and Twitter. Direct your friends to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. That's at stateofbelief.com. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. Our producer is my friend Ray Kirstein. Be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.